Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome to episode 82, a special episode featuring a professional development workshop conducted at the Academy of Management annual meeting in 2021, and which was held virtually. The workshop is called Forgotten Women of Organizational Scholarship and was hosted by Greta and Pedro. This is part one of the episode, where we present the first three of six speakers, Emmanuel Vaast on Jean Maeve, Marta Callas on Edith Penrose, and Marta Feldman on Susan Laystar. To learn more about the event, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to the third edition of our Classics of OMT PDW. Glad you could make it. We have prepared a very exciting program for you. So we will be starting with a short introduction of today's theme, Forgotten Women in Organizational Scholarship. And we'll move then on to the speaker presentations, which are followed by virtual roundtables. And we close with a plenary discussion.
So I imagine that you're all here because you're interested in the classics, right? But before we start, I just wanted to do a quick word on why we think going back to the classics of our field is important. And we think there are at least three reasons. One is that it's a matter of intellectual respect. It shows continuity. And the scholarship is a collective and cumulative effort as we see it. So if we do not do that, we risk reinventing things over and over. Second, it's also a matter of making our scholarship more robust, using the tools of the people that came before us. And third, we think that it gives us some coherence as a field. The classics give us a common ground to stand. And in particular, given the nature of early work, it was one closer to phenomena, which, as Steve Barley puts in his very interesting essay, can be a way to get out of the mystery house we have become. Also, you may wonder why to do the PDW. Well, our impression in doing, working on classics is that most people are sympathetic to the idea, but they tend to refer to the classics through honorific sites, right? And to look at a very narrow part of their work. We think that this could be because we tend to discuss classics only in grad school. Hence, we wanted to create a space to reflect on the past, in the present, also in our main conference. This is how the PDW started in 2018. We see it as a standing initiative. As Greta said, we had two editions. This is the third. And it's also part of a broader effort that Greta and I and other people have in the Talking About Organizations podcast, which is a podcast that is monthly in which we discuss key ideas from foundational organizational theory. We started 6 years ago, and we're happy to say that we have around 18,000 listeners. And it's very much a community resource, and we'd like to acknowledge with gratefulness both the support of our listeners and also of Egos and Management Learning. So we have been thinking about classics for a while. We are very interested in that. But as we have been doing that, we have noticed that there is some danger in the so-called canon. That is, we may end up giving visibility to only a very specific type of voices. And I just wanted to share a vignette that illustrates that. This was the first flyer we had, and I put that next to my office. And then I noticed that on the day after I had, put it there, someone wrote, what do all of these people have in common on the flyer? And, in the flyer you see Taz, you see Taylor, Maslow, Weber, Chester Barnard, and Mary Parker Follett, which are all white, and almost them are all men. And we know that So as part of the work we are doing on classics, we have been trying to not just pay attention to the canon, but also to try to expand it. So for example, we had episodes in the Talking About Organizations podcast about Charles Spalding, which is an important African American figure in management, and also the work of Eduardo Ibarra Collado, who is a Latin American scholar who unfortunately left us too soon.
Yes, and with our podcast talking about organizations, we also try to do justice to the classic work of female scholars in our field. You can, for instance, check these episodes on our website. We wrote the word forgotten in our PDW title, but actually, if you look at history, it's more that women tend to be erased rather than forgotten. There seems to be an awakening to that now, for instance, you know, with movies appearing on popular streaming media such as Netflix, like the great movie Hidden Figures, as well as the Bletchley Circle, celebrating the contributions that women made to key turning points in history. There's also a rediscovery of authors like Marion Weber, who not only was a scholar in her own right, she was also instrumental in finishing the work and broadcasting the work of her husband. So what is considered a classic is usually related to the work of individuals that come from specific social positions related to their geographic location, their racial and gender status. Put simply, or a canon tends to heavily feature male authors. And as Judy Weissman discusses in her book, Managing Like a Man, this is first of all a consequence of the inequalities at home, which many of us have re-experienced during this pandemic we have been in. It's also caused by the gendered nature of scientific knowledge production and reinforced by the selective ways we tend to revisit the past. And as a consequence, the voices of minorities, such as women, are often silenced. And as thought provokingly captured in the movie The Wife, which was one of the key inspirations. When I watched the movie, I was like, Pedro, we need to do something. We need to organize this PDW. So we both realized it takes great effort to make our field more inclusive. And today we hope to just make a very small contribution by providing a space for our community to explore, to learn about and discuss the foundational work of six female scholars: Edith Penrose, Rosabeth Musk-Hunter, Susan Leigh Starr, Rosemary Stewart, Isabel Menzies-Lyth, and Jean Leigh. So together with our fantastic speakers, we'll explore the central insights from their oeuvre, trace their relationships to current discussions in our field, and reflect on the contributions for which these authors deserve more recognition. Due to time restrictions, we won't have time for individual Q&A after each talk, but we encourage you to add your questions to the Google Doc that we shared the link with in the chat, so we can discuss them when we have the plenary discussion, and we have plenty of time then. So the first speaker of today is Professor Emma Vass from McGill. And Emma is a professor of information systems and associate dean of research at McGill Des Hôtels Faculty of Management. She works and publishes both in the fields of information systems and org studies, and has conducted research on knowledge, technology and organizing, and online communities. And today, Emma will discuss the work of Jean Leigh. Over to you, Emma.
Thank you so much, Pedro and Greta, for organizing such an important PDW. It's my pleasure to be here today virtually with all of you, and I'm looking forward to learning more about these other forgotten women in organizational scholarship. So I am interested in my own research, I'm interested in practices, in learning, and from my PhD studies, I actually discovered Jean Leigh's work. She is a social anthropologist, she's still a very active researcher. She's been working for 40 years on learning and practice and context and situated learning and very, very important issues. The one thing I would like to say about Jean Leigh is that I'm not sure she's forgotten. I think she is recognized, she's well cited. Many people who work on practices and try to understand knowledge and learning and context are interested in her work. The one thing I would say, though, is that probably she might be a little misunderstood, at least in management. and also a work, especially today in 2021, a work this really deserve a new view. So obviously I just have a few minutes, so I will focus on some key ideas and concepts that it put forward, but I'm looking forward to more discussions afterwards in the breakout rooms if you have some questions. One of the first works was about math in the real world. She did a study of mathematical practices in supermarkets. So how do people do math in the supermarket? And this was a very critical study, because at the time in the 1980s, and some could say still today, at the time the idea was that knowledge and learning was purely psychological, purely cognitive, right? So in order to do math, you had to be this very genius scientist in a lab or in a classroom. But what she was interested in is actually the everyday problem solving of what she calls the just plain folks. You and I in the supermarket looking at prices, looking at quantities, this is what she was talking about. And she really showed that even though there was so much emphasis on the distinction between science and what people actually do on a day-to-day basis, it was actually very connected. And she really put forward the idea that learning is social rather than just cognitive. In her 1988 book, another idea that she articulates that is very important, I think, for us as social researchers, is that she actually reflects upon the work that social scientists themselves do. So instead of thinking, oh, I'm an anthropologist and I'm going to study people in Africa or people in supermarket and they're my subjects, I'm studying people, but I also have a particular practice. And this practice, the practice of a social researcher, is worth actually self-reflection. So this was a very important idea, and I think we can all benefit from thinking about this as well for our own research. I guess when people think about Jean Lave, the first thing they think about is legitimate peripheral participation and the idea of situated learning. There was this very influential book from 1991 with Etienne Wenger, who was a former student of hers. And this was a really interesting book with many contexts of apprenticeship associated with it. So midwives, tailors in Africa, meat cutters, and the practice of non-drinking alcoholics. So very different contexts that they talk about. But the key idea was to, again, study learning and learning in a particular context, in a particular situation. And this situation that they put forward is the situation of the community of practice. And I think the community of practice idea, so people who are engaged in a practice together, and some who are more newcomers are going to be learning from the masters, from the old timers, and so there's going to be a process of apprenticeship that is going to be the one through which social learning actually happens in a very specific situation. But this idea of community of practice and of situated learning really struck a chord way beyond anthropology. And it struck a chord, it has to be said, in management. And that was very much to the puzzlement of Jean Lave. There's a couple of articles afterwards where Jean Lave talks about the surprising success that her idea of situated learning and of community of practice and its particular, we can say, appropriation in the discipline of management was for her. Because in the book, and that's why I think it's important to really go back to the book itself, in the book, Lave and Wenger really talk about communities of practice as highly political context, has situations where there's going to be resistance, where the old timers and the newcomers, because there's a change in practice, they don't necessarily get along. And yes, for sure, they engage in practice together, but it's not this perfect conflict-free environment that sometimes we have tended to make it out to be. And Lees actually interpret the success and sometimes a misunderstanding associated with situated learning and communities of practice to the fact that the book was published at a time where people started to talk quite a bit about knowledge economy and the commodification of knowledge. And it seemed that situated learning and COPs were a way to actually try to understand this a bit more. So that was 30 years ago already. So obviously Jean Lave's thoughts have changed and have evolved over time. And she released recently, a very interesting book that is a compilation of some of her articles of the years with some more recent thoughts added to it. And I think this book is really worth a look because she thinks about her own work. Again, she's self-reflexive. And most importantly, she starts to broaden the perspective that she has about context and about learning and about practices. So whereas she much of her early work was about knowledge and learning in particular situation, fairly bounded situation, with this new book, she's actually starting to be even more ambitious when she's starting to connect what's happening in a local situation and she's connecting it with what might be happening in broader context. So she's making this connection between situated learning and practices and particular historical, spatial, and institutional context. And the way she does this is through dialectical theorizing. So it's a very ambitious way of seeing things, but I think we could definitely all benefit from taking a look at this. And I think what's really encapsulates our idea is that we are all apprentices to our own changing practices, and I hope we can all learn from Jean Lave. I would like to, as a way of concluding my presentation today, I would like to argue that actually there's much that we can do by rediscovering Lave's ideas that might seem, oh, that was from context from a long, long time ago, but we can actually rediscover many things from going back to Lave and applying it to phenomena that seems very 2021. First one, for instance, algorithmic management of work. So there's a lot of interest in management on this, on what's happening when the algorithm becomes your manager and actually manages the work. Well, if we think about it from Lave's perspective, what this means is that it's not going to be erasing situated learning at all, but there's going to be, again, it's very political, there's going to be some struggles, there's going to be some pockets of resistance, there's going to be some situated learning in order to manage the algorithm that is managing your work, right? So I think this would be a very good context to study and to apply Lave's ideas. Another idea, which is we are finally, maybe at some point, re-emerging from a post-COVID-19 world. But the context of worlds have changed. They have changed because we are both working online and in person. So what does it mean? What does it mean for the context of work? And how can we understand this? And finally, the last aspect is this idea that careers today have become very different than they were before. So what does it mean to be a newcomer and a master in your career when the careers are changing nonstop, right? So I think Lave's idea can be very relevant in this context. And with this, I would like to thank you. Here are some references. I'd be happy to share more if you're interested. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much, Emma. Please join me in giving her an applause on a wonderful talk and giving us this overview. Our next speaker is Marta Kalas. Very happy to have you, Marta. And Marta is a professor of management at the Eisenberg School of Management at University of Massachusetts Amherst. And together with Linda Smirkic, She has conducted foundational work on gender, feminist, and diversity in organization theory. She's also an enthusiast of classic organization theory, leading a graduate course on great books from our field, which heavily features classic scholarship. And today, Marta will tell us about the work of Edith Penrose. Over to you, Marta.
So my argument right here in this particular presentation is that if we think in terms of one particular book from her work that is much more profuse than that, as I will show later, is basically that the theory of the growth of the firm is very often cited and definitely a book that has a great impact in the resource-based view of the firm as in a strategy, as most people who know, I am sure. But I think that, in fact, she is not really that known. That in many ways, not only she is not that known, but that, in fact, even the way she is known, and this has been mentioned by Emmanuel before, is in fact really not what she was intended to do or say or think. And therefore, I just would like to contextualize this talk that I'm going to do now a little bit. First, I have a seminar that all the first year PhD students in my program actually have to take. It's called Great Books, and the Great Books notice the quotation mark, because it's, of course, a critique of the canon at the same time. But Penrose and Mary Parker Follett and Rosabeth Kanter are three women that I introduced into the Great Books when I inherited that course many years ago. And therefore, that is a reason why, you know, she figures very prominently in everything I do, including every year teaching this seminar. But also, she is an important figure in my own writing. I consider her an enigma. And in the seminar, inspired by Foucauldian genealogical approaches, what I try to do is to show how this book provides us the idea and notion of continuities and discontinuity in our field, and that the history that we often portray is old books and new books, as if it were, you know, that we know better now. And what that is a thing that I want to dispute over and over again. Because, in fact, one of the things that have happened in the field is we have forgotten a lot of things. So things that are very old appear suddenly as if they are very new. And it's because of ignorance that have been creating and the continuities and discontinuities have not been followed. And then in my writing as a feminist scholar, I have done a lot of work on epistemological approaches in feminism that in many ways help excavate how knowledge in itself get muted. And the voices of many women scholars have been, in fact, not just muted because they are not cited, but actually muted because their work has been used and abused in so many ways. And so Edith Penrose is one of these cases. So she has, I am putting a lot of biographical notes here, and I'm going to go very fast with them because I don't have that time. But in any case, in this case, the biographical notes are really important because she had a very interesting and complicated life, which in many ways is also important to recognize as part of her work. As amazing, precisely because of how varied and having both a lot of successes and a lot of failure, like not having regular job in a way in which she would wanted it, because even having the offer were oftentimes associated with how her husband was moving from one place to another, and she was given a side job to be able to do something with her that seemed to be very intelligent, but on the other hand, she was a woman. That's one way to think about it. But the other way to think about it is that even under the circumstances, what she accomplished was extraordinary. So, for example, she was in many ways, she married very young, had a son, and the husband was shot like 2 years after she was married in a hunting activity. And then she eventually get together with her husband later, who was her professor in Berkeley. And they, after she graduated from her undergrad in Berkeley, they actually traveled together, went to Geneva to work at the International Labor Organization. And there they were helping Jews to emigrate from Germany because of the upcoming war. So she was involved in a lot of political activity, including later on in the U.S. when they eventually left the country, to help, for example, in the case of McCarthyism, defend a professor who was in fact accused of having un-American or doing un-American activities. So eventually they left the country, England, first to the Middle East and Baghdad in particular. And there she developed an expertise in petroleum industry, and she was become a notable figure in every moment in which the question of oil appeared in the horizon, like in the 1970s. She was a consultant. She knew more about the question of the oil situation in the Middle East than probably anybody else. So anyway, this having been said, she ended up being having a professorship in LSE, in joined with another school, Oriental and African Studies, and then she became professor in INSEAD, when she finally was really a management professor, even though she was an economist all along. And therefore, at that point, she did not teach that famous book that she wrote that, it, you know, acquired all of these expertise and citations, The Theory of the Growth of the Firm. During her time in INSEAD, she wasn't doing even teaching from it. And when she retired, eventually she discovered, in fact, that it had been taken up by management scholarship in strategy. And she was very surprised. So the foreword of her last edition of her book in 1995, very shortly before her death, she addressed the trajectory of the book in the context of changing an organization and organization theorizing during that period. And if you read it today, which I really recommend, you'll see how clear she was in how, in fact, her work was in many ways involved in all of these changes over time. But on the other hand, how her work, in fact, was going to be or needed to be seen in the context of new theorizing. So there are other people who had quoted her, you know, that she was really quite a character. Again, these quotes, if eventually these get produced in some other format, or I am willing to share anybody, with anybody who wants this PowerPoint, again, showing in these cases her uniqueness, that she was not a feminist, but she was one way or another. So there are major moments in the theory of the growth of the firm, and if you have not read the book, again, it's a must read. And for me, it has three gripping moments. The moment in which, at the beginning of the book, she reconsidered that the firm in economic theory, you know, classical economics, is not a firm, and therefore what she is going to do the rest of the book is really giving a body, a real materiality to the firm that the people in practice really recognize as firm. And therefore, she was really a critic of neoclassical economic and even the positivism in the field at that point. And she was, in fact, trying to tell stories about organization in a way that would be recognizable. She at some point mentioned that Ruth Benedict, the anthropologist, was a model for her writing because in so many ways, it was a way to tell stories about the real world and how it was happening. And therefore, this book, actually, even though it's, you know, really an economics book of major proportion, is also a way to move away from the neoclassical economic model, and is a critique of it. The other thing that she does that is a gripping moment, as I tell it, is to talk about how all of this that is happening, like the case of the knowledge, Tacit and otherwise, in the firm as it ongoes processes of learning and knowledge developing in a specific group of people that are the ones that make the organization, each of them different and unique. And all of these are processes, dynamics, and collectivity. So the collective idea of collective knowledge of the firm that is non, in many ways, replicable, is in other places, is really a major contribution in this book. And finally, really many people think that she was an apologist for big business, but in many ways the writing was on the interstices in a growing economy and the importance of small businesses within monopolies that may have been evolving. She was so clear that in fact an economy could not progress if there are not these spaces for the small organizations to appear and continue to be contributors to the economy. So one of the things that I have now in the more recent past written using feminist epistemology, how her name is oftentimes claiming support of the resource-based view, but her voice is barely there. So it had disappeared in the citation records. That's one way to think about it. But it's also being misrepresented tremendously. And therefore, some other people has also noted, for example, that her theory of growth of the firm is a theory of value creation, not of value appropriation, and the idea of using resources for against rivals and the competitiveness of the firm was totally contrary to what she was really trying to portray as much more the collectivities and uniqueness of people working together in organization and making for a better society that it was also appearing in her writing. In a more recent writing that Linda and I was just publishing in the beginning of 2021, we argue together with Bess and Humphrey, 2003, Michael Bess was in fact very close to Penrose during her life. They argue that Penrose's work was also a contribution to feminist economics, because in many ways, her work in fact had an alternative view of human nature that is not a dualistic premises, and in many ways, a deep interest in the world and use metaphor and story alongside spiritual observation to really bring back to the world the real people that inhabit it. And therefore, positivism in economics and dualism in economics was part of her life work, trying to really become a contributor to a counter-alternative, which is relevant and recognizable by any feminist economist. And if you want to know more, in 2017, her daughter-in-law actually wrote another biography. She called it No Ordinary Woman, The Life of Edith Penrose. And my only comment on that is this is a great book in terms of knowing more about her and her work. But also, I wish that there were books now, from now on, in which we don't have to say no ordinary woman, because no woman should be ordinary. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marta, for a great overview of you know, not only the work of Edith Penrose, but also diving a bit into her life. Yeah, I definitely learned a lot. In view of time, let's go on to our third speaker of today. And we're kind of known as the PDW with most names starting with MA. And we have the next one here, Marta Feldman. Very happy to have you, Marta. And Marta is a professor of urban planning and public policy management, political science and sociology. She also holds the Johnson Chair for Governance and Public Management at the University of California, Irvine. She conducted groundbreaking research in organizational routines and the development of practice theory and org theory. Today, Marta will talk about the work of Susan May Starr. Over to you, Marta.
First of all, I want to say I really enjoyed Emma's and Marta's presentations, and I look forward to the next three presentations. This is a wonderful project that you've put together, and I really appreciate the organizers and the other presenters. I have already learned a lot this morning. I am a bit daunted by the prospect of presenting Susan Lee Starr's work, and one of the reasons for being daunted is it is voluminous, it's expansive, it is evocative, it is kind of hard to capture in small bits. But I do resonate with what both Emma and Marta have already talked about of a person whose work is not forgotten by a long shot. Her work has been used a lot in management theory and used a lot very broadly, in fact. And also with the sense that in the use of that work, the work has been simplified, including in my own use of that work. And it's been really interesting for me to kind of sink into her work and understand more of its complexities, which I will try to present and do justice to. So as many of you know, Susan Lee Starr, who went by the name of Lee, so I will probably refer to her as Lee or Starr. I titled this presentation, A Trajectory Interrupted, in part because she did pass away at the age of 56, as you know, when she was still clearly a very, very active in her career, and it was very much an untimely death. And that's actually another, you know, part of the reason for being daunted, because, of course, she was part of a very active community, part of which she had created. And that community came together after her death, and there are many tributes to her work. One of the best that I would recommend, and I should have made a picture of it, is a book called Boundary Objects and Beyond. And it's a compilation of both her own work, but also work of her students and colleagues that speaks to, again, the voluminousness of her work. Let me say a little bit about what I see as some of her inspirations. She was, first of all, an inductive observer, an inductive researcher. So inductive observation was clearly very important to the work that she did. And a lot of that inductive observation was on issues of marginality. She was very interested in things like invisible work and classifications that produce marginality. And I probably should have put here, produce marginality and privilege. In a minute, I'll talk about kind of projects. And it's clear that the projects that she was interested in were not always projects that she liked, wanted to move forward, even though she was interested in how they do move forward. The other really strong inspiration for her was community. And there are two aspects in which community was extremely important to her. And one is kind of just the sociological orientation to work collaboration. So it's it's community as sociology. It's kind of thinking about groups as opposed to individuals or more than individuals, but also thinking about what goes on as individuals work in collaboration. The other sense in which community was really important was the creation of a community of practice, which of course is a term that Emma noted it comes from Jean Lave's work. Lee was very, very much at the center of a community of practice that was created around the issues of work practices and information systems. And that's a very vibrant community represented by several journals. One of the first journals in that area was CSCW, Computer Supported Collaborative Work. And Lee was one of the founding editors of that. So in this kind of vibrant area of the overlap between information systems and organizations, the thing that Lee is most known for and I guess the biggest contribution she made here is in this area of boundary objects. And that is the topic that has been both, I think, understood and misunderstood, and very much used, seen as a very useful contribution, but at the same time, I think, in many ways, underestimated. If we think about what are boundary objects, these are just some of the things that she identified as boundary objects. In some of her work, she talks about, there's a really nice piece called What is Not a Boundary Object? And she talks about how many people have used this and that one of the most frequent questions she gets when she gives talks was what is not a boundary object? Because it was appropriated very broadly. And she talks about the fact that she did not make any effort to kind of restrict or discipline the use of that term, which I think makes sense for people and very much from the in the STS world of kind of people picking things up and using them for their own purposes. It made a lot of sense. And at the same time, it also produces a simplification of, it, in fact, what she was about. So all these things, forms and labels, repositories, prototypes, these things can be boundary objects, but it's also important to think about what do boundary objects do. And as I mentioned earlier, it's about moving projects forward. So boundary objects help communities move projects forward, but in the condition where there is no authoritative leadership. So sometimes she talks about where there's no consensus, and I'm not quite on board with that. I think there might be more consensus than she had seen, but at least without authoritative leadership. And some examples of that are like in scientific communities where different scientists might be trying to promote different kinds of solutions to similar problems. And in communities of privilege. So, for example, when I talked earlier about kind of classifications that produce marginality, like one of the things she used, one of the examples she used in several publications is race classifications under apartheid. And of course, we could say race classifications more broadly. So those communities are not necessarily communities that she lauded their forward movement, but could see how that was happening. The other thing that boundary objects do, which I think is part of the project that is less developed and would have been more developed had Lee continued to be able to produce, is that they enable due process, what she called due process, or providing some means of adjudicating conflicting claims. So I think standards may be an example of that, where different people relate to the standards in different way, but the standards provide some way of saying this is something, this is not that thing. But I think it's important, and it was an important for me in sinking into this work to recognize that the meanings of both object and boundary are more than initially meets the eye. So I got some kind of texty quotes from Lee about objects, where they're, are they objects or are they actions or are they practices? Became more of a question for me, where in this, again, in this piece that was published posthumously, but written, obviously, just before she died, about what is not a boundary object. She says an object is something people, or in computer science or other objects and programs, act toward and with. Its materiality derives from action, not from a sense of prefabricated stuff or thingness. And in that same piece, she talks about the object, which she says, remember to read this as a set of work arrangements that are at once material and processual. So while many of us, I think myself included, have focused more on the object and the materiality, she, in her work, she saw that materiality and the practice as combined, which is very similar to a kind of the socio-material project of people like Vonda Orlikowski, Luciana Daddario, Lucy Suchman, who have been articulating this entanglement of actions or practices. So I'll just say, you know, boundaries are also similarly complicated. And at one point she says that she thought about calling them marginal objects for various reasons to refer to them as boundary objects. I think I'll stop there since I am over 10 minutes and I don't want to take up more time. I want to emphasize how much this was a community project. And the slide that I haven't shown is really about her publication process, which I think is really quite interesting in kind of seeing how much this was a field in development and a community in development, with the number of special issues and edited volumes that is where her work, where you can find her work. I'll stop there. Thanks for your attention.
We thank all our guest speakers for making this event a tremendous success, and the Academy of Management for allowing us to host the workshop.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.